today, in celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, we're going to examine the prayer on behalf of the State of Israel, the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMdina. And those who were able to be here with us last night sung so beautifully as a wonderful entree to our Tefillah Chagigiyah. And what I wanted to do is look a little bit at the hotly disputed history of the authorship of this Tefillah. I want to look a little bit at the literary elements to analyze it almost like a beautiful piece of poetry. So we have our literature expert sitting to my right, and then to look at perhaps the theology also of the Tefillah. But before we jump in, just I mentioned this morning for those who are here at Shacharit, but the whole, just to preface in celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, the very existence of Tefillah like this, I think, is deserving of celebration. If you think about it for a moment, we have a prayer for this state in our tradition. We still recite it. In fact, there's a fascinating history of the Tefillah for the other kingdom, for the government, you know, the local government, etc. But the Tefillah for the State of Israel, that... you can tell them it's for me, if you want. Okay. The prayer for the government of whatever country we find ourselves in, that has actually, there's even a halachic obligation to recite that. It goes back to there's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says that we are required to pray for the welfare of a country in which we find ourselves. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot teaches that an individual should pray for the welfare of the government. One is obligated to pray for the welfare of the government.
And you can even go back further. You can go back to when Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, he blessed Paro.
For sure, yes.
That was excellent. First example of a head of state who was blessed by a Jew.
Very nice, well said. So there's a very rich history of our obligation even to pray for the welfare of another country. But... What? Yeah. I got it. Hi, how are you? All right, give me 1 second. I won't be right back.
Excuse me, so when did the name change take place and why?
I don't recall.
Neither did I.
I
don't even remember the
vague
first
recollection that we did name it Torah and Tehillah.
Right.
So that it would be, you know, Torah.
Right. But I don't remember that ever happening.
But then,
all right. It took care of that.
Because it was harder.
She was directly from the boss.
There you go. Okay. Watch, there's going to be another set of students that comes up. Yom HaAtzmaut, tell them not to play music. All right.
Well, drums aren't exactly music.
Alright, that I'm going to stay well clear.
A-tone.
I'm steering well clear of that today.
It's percussion.
Okay. Alright, so to pick it up again. So there's a long history of praying for the welfare of another state. And in fact, there is a fascinating history of the specific text of the prayer that we still say nowadays. In fact, you can find all sorts, even just go online and do a quick search, you can find all sorts of fascinating facsimiles and photocopies from a variety of sidurim from throughout really the centuries of prayers in which we even inserted the name of the king or queen. So, right, so whether it's Ferdinand and Isabella, whether it's the Tsar in Russia, whether it's Frederick Wilhelm, you have these actual, it's a fascinating topic in its own right. I once even heard a lecture from Jonathan Sarnoff, who is probably the leading historian of American Jewish history. It's a fascinating presentation. He argues that the prayer for the welfare of the state, not for Medina Israel, but for the local government, is actually a form of satire that goes back to the times when we were under anti-Semitic czars and the like. So in other words, it was the concept, of course, is genuine. We truly want and we truly want to partner with the government. But under governments that were anti-Semitic in previous eras in history, it was a little bit more complicated. We were a little two-faced about it, because when Jews were being oppressed, beaten in the streets, and all sorts of terrible things, we couldn't genuinely aspire toward this government continuing to act in this way, and yet We needed to be good citizens in order to keep ourselves as safe as we possibly could be. And so there's sort of a polemical, sort of satirical component to us. There's a fascinating history of that. Take that, Jerry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it reminds me of the line from Fiddler on the Roof, "May the Lord keep the Tsar."
That's it.
Far away from us.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So all significant Jewish traditions can ultimately be traced back somehow to Fiddler on the Roof. There's no question about that. This is surely no exception.
I can detect a chair here.
We'll slide over there.
Don't kill yourself. Yeah.
You missed. Got my balance. Right.
We're good.
I forgot that has wheels.
Good. Yeah, Lisa.
Thanks.
That is for you. All right, so the prayer for the state, for the foreign state, has a much more complex history. And take it in that context of the comparison to a quasi-satirical text that was aimed specifically as a criticism in certain ways of an obscure, hidden criticism of other states. So take that alongside the miracle of being able to write a prayer for our own state, I think is truly worthy of celebration. And for that alone, Dayenu, to say just how fortunate we find ourselves in today's world after all of our history. But in that regard, I think it's really valuable, and it's a great opportunity for us to examine this tefillah and say, what is, just like any other tefillah, how is it written, who composed it, what are its themes, what are its motifs, and how can we enrich our own appreciation so that next Shabbat, as we recite the tefillah l'shalom hamdina, whenever we encounter it, and we can find it to be all that much more meaningful and significant. So what I want to do is to start with the authorship of the tefillah, Avinu Sheba Shemayim, and then we're going to actually take a look at the exact text and try to understand it. There is a raging debate in the historical literature. There's actually a burgeoning historical literature around the tefillah for Medina Israel. This is now subject to a PhD thesis, which is written by now Dr. Dov Rappel out of Boston University in 2008. He's really an Israeli professor. I guess he came abroad to do his studies, ironically, in Avinu Sheba Shemayim, went back to Israel. I don't think he's completed his book, but I believe he's approaching publication, something along those lines. I haven't seen his PhD. I really want to get the dissertation. But there's a burgeoning literature, and even in Hatzofah or other places, there's been a series of different articles that have been published by historians, by journalists, trying to trace it. The history goes back to something very interesting. I wanted to start. By the way, who do you suggest? Who have you heard? Those who were here this morning, I mentioned something about it, so you can't cheat. If you weren't here at Chakrat this morning, and then if you were, does anyone have any guesses? Like, what is it? Does it conjure any names for you?
Repeat the question.
Yeah, who wrote the tefillah?
Oh, who wrote it? I think
the author. Rabbi Goren.
Did I mention it last week?
Yes. What?
No, not Rabbi Goren. No, before him. Right, so I mentioned it last week. That's why. Okay, so good. All right, so there's a raging debate. For many, many years, it was ascribed to Agno, to Shai Agno, the Nobel Prize winner, which is absolutely fabulous. That's a suggestion. At the same time, the two chief rabbis at the time of the founding of the State of Israel, which we discussed at some length this very last week, Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel, they also were very much heavily involved in this. And there's been a major dispute. And in fact, last week, the shiur that we had on the topic of the tefillot of Yom HaAtzmaut. So after I gave it, I posted it online. I put it up on yutorah.org. And they have like this section where they feature different shiurim. So they, since I put it up a week before Yom HaAtzmaut, they had a whole week leading up to Yom HaAtzmaut, so they put it up. So if they feature it, so it gets lots of hits. So I got some really interesting emails this week from people who were listening to it and really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. And one of the people who emailed me was a guy named Meir Weingarten. I had not previously met, I still haven't met, I believe, hadn't previously heard of Meir Weingarten. Anyone who listens to JM in the AM, to Nachum Siegel, however, will know that apparently they have a show together around Israel-related issues. He gave me the whole background and the whole story, and I mentioned his name to two other people. I was like, who is he? They're like, yeah, Nachum Siegel, JM in the AM. They're like this, they're buddies. It's like, okay, great. So anyhow, so he emailed me. He is, among other things, a great-grandson of Rav Uziel. It's a great-grandson of the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. and he attached an article from Hatzofeh from many years ago of a journalist slash historian who had argued that many people think that Agnon wrote it. Many people think Rav Herzog was the author, but in fact there's additional evidence that Rav Uziel was the primary author. So it's his great grandfather. He's like advocating for his great grandfather. It's very touching. And apparently Rav Uziel published a booklet, a choveret of tefillot in piyutim, especially around the Yom Narayim, around Shayim Kippur. It was not widely known that he was a liturgical poet, and so it made more sense than it was initially understood that Rav Uziel was the primary author. So I didn't come to resolve this historical debate, but it is a fascinating discussion as to how exactly this worked. And if you take a look, I actually went online and I found the archives. I emailed a guy named Dr. Yoel Finkelman, who works in the National Library, and he's an outstanding scholar and someone that I've become friendly with. Yoel Finkelman, I didn't email him. I Facebook messaged him, of course. How else do I communicate with someone these days? And I asked him, where's the link? How can I find the initial publication of the Tefillah L'Shalom Hamdina? I'm curious to get the evidence. And it turns out it's in Hatzofeh, which was the religious Zionist publication at that time. Hatzofeh published this on September 20, 1948. So if you take a look at page 2 at the bottom, you'll see the left. Or in Hebrew, it's reversed. 20 is the day of the month, and then the 9 is the number of the month. So it's 29, September 20, 1948. Tet Zayin Elo, Tav Shin Chet, published on a Monday in Hatzofeh. So that's from the top of the. It's two. It was just two sides at that time. It was a small. Wow. It's a small Israeli paper, and you can go online, you can find this, happy to send you the link. And I went to the archives and I started looking through, and I found September 20, and it's very hard to find it because they're not scanned. They're scanned clearly, but you can't easily see the entire page at once. So you have to like drag the cursor. So you like look at had to examine. It took me about 10-15 minutes, but finally it was there, I found it. So it says like this on page 3, Tefillah L'Shalom Medina Yisrael. This is the first publication ever, historically, of this tefillah. So it introduces the Tefillah L'Shalom Medina. It says, Maranan v'Rabanan harabanim harashiyim le'eretz Yisrael. Right, the great chief rabbis of the land of Israel. And it stands, it refers to Rav Yitzchak Isaac Hagon, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. So it's referred to the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, the Hagon Rav Ben Sion Uziel. So this is Rav Uziel, Behaskamat, with the agreement of the Chaverei Hamoetza, the members of the leadership, Virashe Harabanim, and the heads of the chief rabbis, Shel Tel Aviv, Haifa, Upetach Tikva, Shlita. So these rabbis together, Yisdu V'Tiknu, established and instituted Hatfilah Shelehalan, the following prayer, Lehe Amir, to be recited, B'chol Batei HaKneset Ba'aretz, in all synagogues in Israel, U'vitfutzot, and in the diaspora, Al Yidei Harav, I think it's a typo here, and I think they misprinted it, I'd say Al Yidei HaShatz, either by the rabbi, or by, what's the shatz? The Shliach Tzibur, the Chazan. So this should be recited by the rabbi or the chazan. It doesn't say the gavai, but it's interesting. But b'shabbatot u'moadim, on Shabbatot and holidays. Interesting. Different communities have different practices as to whether or not to recite the Tefillah L'Shalom Hamdina, etc. on holidays. So the initial suggestion from the chief rabbis was to include holidays as well. Acharei Kriyat HaTorah.
And it looks like they got it in right before.
Before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Yeah. Well, right, well said. Exactly, right before the holiday period. Very nice. Right, Acharei Kriyat Torah. Interesting as well, we put it after Yom Kippur, right, which makes sense because they're all tefillot for the community.
Right.
But it's interesting, it doesn't specify exactly where it goes. It just says after, following the laning. And then
after
it gives us. After Lent, yeah.
Are you saying? You said
I didn't say it in Yom Ha'atzmaut language.
Oh,
so I said in Yiddish. It wasn't. That threw you off. Okay. All right. And then it gives us the text, which we're going to go through in just a moment. And then if you jump over, it adds. This is part of the evidence that's been brought to bear. Again, I haven't worked through all the arguments in all the different directions, but this is certainly a relevant proof text. So on the second side, right there. after the actual prayer. It says, "Kedai litzayin." It's worthy to note, "Sha'al pihaz manat harav harashi hagon Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog hishtatif hasofer shai agnon afhu benisuach hatzfila." On the basis of the invitation of Chief Rabbi Herzog, Agnon, also the great author Agnon, also contributed to the formulation of the tefillah, which gives me, by the way, an opportunity to correct something of a mistake. For those who were here last week, I mentioned that Agnon was not fully observant. So I just want to correct that, because in the email, Mayor Weingarten mentioned that he wasn't sure. So I went back, I looked at the history. So I had remembered it, but only partially. So it's worthy of correction. There was a time when, like many other young Zionists who were living in Eastern Europe, he became disaffiliated from religious practice. He was always religiously engaged, but he was no longer observant for a time. But my impression is that once he came back to Israel, he did once again restore his full observance. So that's...
At the end of his life.
He was... Yeah, and then I think it's... I don't know the exact... I don't know how...
Much earlier.
I think that's what... That was my impression from the work, that there was a short period of time when... And that was kind of... Unfortunately, if you take a look at the trends, I mean, the percentages of people living in Eastern Europe in... This is like in the 1920s. It was who were still observant was extremely small. It had already started, you know, in the 50 years following when Haskalah hit Eastern Europe hard, about 100 years after it hit Western Europe, I mean, the level of observance unfortunately dropped at a precipitous rate, and Agnon was caught up with those winds. But once he came back to Israel, my impression is that he became once again fully observant. So obviously this text seems to imply that the primary authors were the chief rabbis, and then together with them, Agnon contributed as well. By the way, this same article, I was not able to get this online, still a work in progress, but it's not available for free online from what I can find. They have the archives of almost every Israeli circular and different publications from the early years that are all available for free. Haaretz doesn't seem to be, so maybe it's available through the website, maybe they want you to pay for it. I don't know what the story is. The very next day, the same piece essentially, more or less, was published in Haaretz, so September 21. So first they put it in the religious Zionist newspaper, and then the next day they put it in the secular paper. So I was able to find someone had cut and pasted the language type, so I used that in lieu of the original copy. So there they said it like this, more or less the same thing. Harav Anim Rashim Eretz Yisrael, the chief rabbis of Israel, Harav Isaac Yitzchak Herzog, Harav Ben Sion Uziel. By the way, you can see the difference. They took out the Gaon, they took out the Gimel for Gaon, they took out the acronym. It's kind of like made appropriate for their more secular audience. Yistu v'tiknu b'haskamat chaveirei hamoetzav rabbanim harav rashi rabbanim shel Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Upetach Tikva. Even here, it's interesting, right? Tel Aviv in the... I don't know if you can be medayik in all of these, but in the Hatzofer version, Tel Aviv is written out. Mm-hmm. And here it's Tav Aleph. It's almost like the acronyms, what they use as acronyms, what they're accustomed to, are reversed. When it comes to Hagon, Harav, etc., like, not to the religious newspaper, you get all the acronyms. Like, everyone knows what that is. In Haaretz, they omit part / write it out. And then when it comes to Tel Aviv, it's like you write it out in the religious Zionist newspaper, but right, it's just Tav Aleph, right? You just know how the Haaretz audience has it. I don't know if the latter one is necessarily correct, but it's just a guess. So they establish it Tatfilot HaMuvit Le'el, Tfilah HaMuvit Le'el, so they had published it immediately preceding. Le'hei Amer, so we recited B'chol Batei Knesset V'aretz U'Vitzvutzot Aydi HaRav HaShatz, and they explain what a shatz is, right? Again, as opposed to Hatzofeh, Shuliach Tzibur, HaChazan, right? The one leading the prayers, B'Shabbatot V'modim Achar Kriyat HaTorah. I also found in my search a couple of things that are available online. This is, we're not going to read it through right now. That's a little bit difficult. Although I've done some work on it. There are a couple of words I wasn't able to get, at least not yet. But this is mostly the same as the Tfilah Shlomo Amina with which we're familiar, but slightly different. This is in the handwriting of Shai Agnon. Come on, that's really cool. And you can see that his handwriting was Subtle. This actually, you know what it reminds me of? I don't know, for some reason, you have to work really hard. It's one word at a time. So Avinu, you can see, page 4, right? Avinu, Shebashamayim, Sur Yisrael, V'goalo, Barechet Medina, that's Yisrael, at the beginning of the second line. That's Reshit Smichat Geulatin. You can make it out. It's mostly the same. There are parts that are different. And you also see it, you see in the middle section, he's got two additions in lighter print, mm-hmm. that with the underlines.
Yeah.
You see, that's V'han Chilenu, like they're working out the spelling, and there's Ta'at Reim, right, is also there. It's again, it's not identical. There are a couple of differences. So this is pretty remarkable. These are available online. You can find them. I don't remember exactly where I found this one, but this is something I found on a website. And then, and I don't know the history of this, and again, hopefully I'll read Rappel's dissertation, I'll understand this better, but there's an earlier version. Where are you?
It was at the end of a sentence.
Where are you?
Seems underlined. The words that seem underlined. Just a break.
I think it's maybe a change in the spelling. There's a debate. I don't think so. I think it might actually be... I think they're corrections. It's not clear 100% what this is. According to some, this is Agnon... Some bring this to bear as evidence that Agnon was the primary author because he's writing in his own pen, etc. Some suggest that he copied it over from the chief rabbis but then made some edits. Right? But this is him working it out. This is nearly the final, it's close to the final text, and he's making some edits. So, for example, it says, the bottom one, the second correction there, is a difference between Va'atar Nitzachon Ta'atareim, right? In other words, with a crown of victory, you should crown them, or Ta'atareim Nu.
Oh, yes.
You should crown us. So it's a correction, it's a suggested change. Mm-hmm. The former was accepted in the final version, we say Ta'atareim. We're talking about the Chayalim of Tzahal.
So he's two options there.
And the Hanchileim, he changes to the Hanchileinu. Yeah. So that's the difference there as well. So those are clearly corrections. Again, what the significance of this is, was he taking it from the chief rabbis, or was he transcribing it himself and then making his own edits? We don't know. At least I don't know for sure. But that's pretty cool. On the second page, you can see he crosses some things out. So he's really working on it. I'm not sure 100% what that is. Right before Vahufa Bahadar Geonuzecha. By the way, there are one or two very, very subtle differences between the way that it was published in Hatzotha and Haaretz versus the way that we say it, but very, very minor. For example, we generally say Vahufa Bahadar Geonuzecha, right? To reveal, we ask God to reveal Himself. And in the Haaretz, if you go back to the Hatzotha one, it says, I think it says Hofa. I'm pretty sure. At the top of the second column, back in the Hatzofe one, Hofa Badar Gonzecha. Very, very small differences, but just worthy of note. And in the last manuscript, the historical document that I gave you, this is labeled. I don't know the background exactly, but this is clearly a somewhat different version. And I've heard a version along these lines actually in other shuls. So I don't know exactly the difference, but if you take a look on page 6, so this is an archive from the chief rabbi's office. They have mentioned last time there's this Rabbi Shmuel Katz. Rabbi Shmuel Katz is the chief researcher of the chief rabbinate archives. It sounds interesting that there's such a position. It's really unusual. But he's actually published an entire book about two volumes about the history of the chief rabbinate. He has some fascinating things in there. Go ahead, Jerry.
Is he also the author of Lone Wolf, the two-volume biography about Jabotinsky? Shmuel
also,
Katz,
I'm not sure. It might be the same. I'm not sure. Good question. I don't know. Look into it. What? I don't know. There might be a bibliography. Do I have it? Oh, no, that's the... Yeah, Jabotinsky. Hill Halkin recently wrote one for Shocking Books.
Yeah, that's a different one.
Oh, no, I know that. But if you wanted to check, you could... I bet they reference it over there as well. Anyhow, so this is in his archives. By the way, just as a note, one thing I learned between last week and this, those who were here, and even if you weren't, we talked about Hallel and Hallel with a bracha, Hallel without a bracha, and how the chief rabbis were caught in between their own positions and the rest of the chief rabbinate council, who were more lowercase c conservative and did not want to be as aggressive in terms of the tefillah that they wanted to establish. he claims that he has insider information that the chief rabbis both wanted to say institute challah with a bracha, and that that was their firm halachic position, but they felt that that wouldn't fly, that they wouldn't be able to build consensus, so they decided in the initial publication at least to publicize it without halal. FYI, also came to understand that in 1974, when Rav Goren was the chief Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, he organized a council, and they came together to declare that at this point, given the strides that Israel has taken, post-Six-Day War, and so on and so forth, and the greater economic security and existential security, they came together and said that even those chief rabbis, etc., who would have said that you say halal without a bracha, now they think you should say it with a bracha. Very interesting. A lot of really interesting developments around that whole question in terms of what we should say. And yeah, this version's a little bit different. This is, again, attributed to Agnon, but I don't know if we know who had this initial document. So it says like this: Avinu Shabashamayim Hashkifa Mimaon Kadshecha. Has anyone seen this text in context of a tefillah for Israel? I saw this once in one community, something along these lines. Look out from your holy place. That's from the prayer that the farmer would recite upon bringing the Bikurim. Uvarech et Medina Yisrael, and bless the state of Israel. And this I found to be one of the most interesting pieces here. Reshit Geulatenu.
Tzmichat's
not there. There was some debate, there was some back and forth exactly how to formulate this line, what we'll come back to in just a few moments. And then it continues, again, some differences, and this obviously significantly condensed from the final version. So there's some fascinating further research to be done, some great history to this. Let's leave that aside for the moment. So let's circle back to page one, and let's actually take a look at the prayer. Let's learn it together as we would any other tefillah. And we're going to see that we're going to divide this tefillah into two major sections. So we start, Avinu Shabashamayim, Suri Yisrael v'go'alo, Barich et Medina Yisrael, Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. Our Father in Heaven, we're going to examine these early lines, we're going to examine at some length. Avinu Shabashamayim, our Father in Heaven, Suri Yisrael v'go'alo, Rock and Redeemer of Israel. So we ask to bless the state of Israel, the first manifestation, they say, of the approach of our redemption. All right, they don't use the flowering. This is just what I found on Sfaria. Don't take this English translation as authoritative or as mine. But you can already get a sense from the English as to this phraseology of Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, the beginnings of the flowering, that's how it translated, of our redemption. Like, you want to say that it's the beginning of the Geula, but you want to hedge. And so it's the beginning. At the beginning, it's not the beginning, right? It's not like we said, it's not Reshit Geulatenu. It's not Tzmichat Geulatenu. It's Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. And it reflects an honest ambivalence, not about the importance and the religious value of the process, but about the religious category that we ought to assign to the state of Israel. Because clearly all would agree that we're not there yet. It's not the full Geula. It's not the Messianic era in the full-fledged sense of the term. And yet there was a true sense that, especially in the shadow of the Holocaust, this is not just an extraordinary miracle, but has the seeds of the beginning of the redemption within it. I mean, for anyone who experienced that transition from 1945 to 1948 and saw or heard Ben Gurion reading the Megillat HaAtzmaut, the Declaration of Independence, and it's just the sense, whether you can find it online, I have a friend who shared this, you can go back, you can, and there are a lot of, there are English subtitles also for the entire talk. It's, if you have a few extra minutes and looking for something for Yom HaAtzmaut, it's definitely something that could be high on your list. Anyhow, so there's an ambivalence in terms of how to assign the category religiously, and that's manifest in this text. There are also different versions. In Israel, they tend to be more messianic. Anglo rabbis have been a little bit less so. Rav Soloveitchik was not a messianic Zionist by any stretch, and he felt that there's extraordinary religious significance to the state of Israel, but we ought not assign messianic significance to it. In Israel, there's more receptivity to that idea, those who lived through those experiences, and then compounding 1948 with 1967, right, the outright explicit miracle of the Six-Day War, there's the sense of messianic fervor that you don't really have outside of Israel in quite that same way. All right, we continue, and then again we'll circle back once we read it through. Hagin aleha be'evrat chastecho. We ask God to shield it with your loving kindness. Ufros aleha sukkah shalomecha, to drape over her the sukkah of peace, of your sukkah of peace. Ushlach orcha v'amtcha l'rashi ha'sareha v'yotzeha, to send your light and your truth, veracity, in other words, a sense, an insight, to its leaders, its officers, its advisors, and establish a correct, excellent insight for them before you. Now there's a transition. Megine, Magen, Magen Avraham, that's a shield. So we're now turning from the leadership of the state of Israel to its defenders, to its fighters. So strengthen the hands of the defenders of our holy land. V'hanchilim Elokeinu Yeshua, give them the inheritance of salvation. V'atar nisachom tatrim, as we said earlier, adorn them, crown them with the crown of victory. V'natata shalom ba'aretz v'simchat olam yosheveha, and you shall give peace to the land and joy, everlasting joy to its inhabitants. Remember, this is being completed and published at what time? During the war. Right? The war begins on May 14th. Begins on Hey Elul. This is just published just a few short months later. It's 4 months later. That's all it is. So we are. It's a wartime prayer, and so there's of course that emphasis, which should always be there. And I'm sure that was part of the balance they were trying to strike as well. It wasn't meant to be a wartime prayer. It was meant to be far more long-lasting, and yet there was an acknowledgement of the frailty of the security situation for the fledgling state.
And also, I think that one could think about what goes into a defense of a country. It's also its integrity and its day-to-day running. We don't have to give any examples, but if things aren't running smoothly, the country is not in great shape.
Absolutely.
So I think this goes even for peacetime.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you're saying that the army needs to be run. You're saying the army or everything?
No, I'm saying everything. Mm-hmm. Every branch of government needs to run well for a country, in my opinion, for a country to be well defended. Because otherwise things start to crumble.
So you're saying there's an overlap between the general prayer for the wisdom of the state and its security, the wisdom of all members of branches of government itself feeds into the security of the country.
Right. Also, just as far as the American saying that the prayer for America, I remember during Vietnam, some people would sit and not say it. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, Dafka, when the government is a mess, that's when we need to say the prayer even more fervently.
So I think I mentioned this in one of our classes at one point this year. Tell me if I didn't. But there was a really interesting debate around the time of the election. There were different rabbis who, on opposite sides of the political spectrum, said, that's it, we're not comfortable with certain formulations of the prayer. The one in which you elevate, the truth is that the line about elevating the stature, not just giving insight like this one has, right? Which is this was written also as a fundamental difference. It's not just obviously Israel versus other countries. This is written for a democratic leadership, for a democratic government. That was really written for, well, often despots. I mean, we're talking about dictatorships. We're talking about autocracies, a very different kind of context. So one of the versions that's commonly recited today for the prayer for the welfare of the state, not of Israel, is to elevate and to glorify the leader of the state. We talk about it's in there, yeah. V'ala v'romim v'gadel v'naseh lemala tanasi v'et mishneo. Right? That's all that. So the truth is that whatever one's political orientation, that kind of doesn't sound like a democratic kind of context, and it's not drawn from one. So there's a question about whether or not that needs to be tweaked anyway. All right, so to come back, so just remind ourselves. So the first thing is we ask God to bless to pledge the country. That's piece number one. Piece number two is that we ask God to protect the protectors of the country. And then we turn v'atachinu kol b'Yisrael pekadna b'char tzot pizureihem. So now we turn outward to the diaspora, and we ask God to To remember, in other words, right, don't forget about those Jews who are living in other places, and to recall them as well, and not so much to recall them that they should be successful where they are, but in keeping with the messianic vision to do what? Right, of course. Right, to come back. And we cite the psukim from Parsha Nitzavim, that even if we are distanced to the ends of the heavens, from there God should bring you back. So there's a prayer for Kibbutz Galuyo, which is, of course, the great messianic vision that we have. And those psukim themselves seem to be messianic in nature, too. That we should be multiplied and become manifold. And then we add another prayer before we come to the conclusion. Umal Hashem is also taken from those same sukkim. We're just continuing the quote, give the quotations there. Umal Hashem lokecha levavchavi levav zarecha. Make sure to ask God to circumcise our hearts, which is we talked earlier about the ethics or the moral fiber of the country. And here we're talking about the circumcision of the heart, the purity of heart, the religious character of our people during the Messianic era. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his comments to this pasuk, specifically identifies this as a vision for Yimot HaMashiach. He sees the circumcision of the heart as a restoration of the experience of Gan Eden. So this is clearly messianic in nature. And then finally, what are we drawing from here? V'yachid levavinu li'ava li'rat shemecha. Where's that taken from? Right, excellent. The prayers for Kriyat Shema. Have a rabba. By the way, of all the tefillot, when someone asks, you know, why are tefillot so dry? They sometimes feel uninspiring, etc. So one of the tefillot that I think we can point to that's on a daily basis that we say that's unbelievably inspiring and uplifting is this tefillah. I find Ava Rabba to be absolutely gorgeous. V'yachid l'mavinu l'aval yirad shemecha, to unify our hearts, to love you, to revere you. It talks about Torah as not just a cerebral intellectual experience, but something that's uplifting, it's transformative. It's an absolutely stunning tefillah. It's really very uplifting, and so it's appropriate in that sense. And again, there's a recognition from the chief rabbis and from Agnon, this is not just about the secularism of the country. It's not only about being successful like any other state, but it comes ultimately with the circumcision of the heart, that there's a vision that this lead to religious redemption. There was an acute awareness on the part of the founding of the chief rabbis that this was complicated. Again, that it was an extraordinary miracle, and yet religiously, the leadership of the country was in a very different place. Ben Gurion and the others were not just not observant, but in many ways they were anti-religious. That was the ethos of this secular Zionist movement over the course of a number of decades already, and it was precisely that group that had been successful to a large degree. They were the driving force behind the establishment of the state. So there was, again, ambivalence that we've accomplished so much, and yet the religious dimension still leaves much to be desired, and so that's part of the prayer that they include. All the words of your Torah, and again, this should be a harbinger of the Messianic era. I always have to think when I say that line. What does that mean? Liftot to, oh, it's pidyon.
Redeem.
Right, to redeem. Mechakei kitz yeshuatecha. Lechako, maza lechako, right? To await, right? Kitzishuatecha, right? The ends of your salvation, right? So awaiting, again, the coming of the Messiah. Hufa b'hadar geon zecha. Here we have it without the vav. Appear with the glory of your strength. Alkol yeshvei tzvartzecha, to all the people who live on earth. Yomar kol asher neshama v'yapo. Hashem elokei yisrael melech u'malchuto b'kol mashalah min selah. That all human beings should declare the dominion of God. Anyone know where this last section is drawn from? From other tefillot that we recite over the course of the year. Very appropriate for the timing in which it was published. Right. Excellent. Where? And Yom Kippur.
Yes.
Depends on what tune your chazan uses. Mm-hmm. That's what I grew up with. Maybe he's heard other tunes over the course of your time, but it comes from the bracha in on Rosh Hashanah. It's the bracha of Malchiyot. It's the bracha where we ask God, right, for His dominion to be restored. And I don't know if it's any good. It's Rosh Hashanah specifically, it's that high holiday vision that everything that we're doing now is going to, and Rosh Hashanah has the universal element as well. All of mankind is judged on Rosh Hashanah. So there's that vision that one day this is going to be something that it's not just a couple of Jews that are reciting, it's not just a minority, but it's going to be universal. It's universal vision. It's for all of humanity. When Malka Simkovich was here, she spoke about this a little bit. Her book is on this theme of universalism in earlier Jewish sources. And so this idea that in Judaism, we don't believe that everyone needs to convert, but that the predominant view has been and remains that Messianic era does not mean everyone's going to be Jewish. That there is such a minority view, but the major thrust of our tradition is that everyone will be an ethical monotheist, that everyone will together worship God, and that's really the vision. So this idea that everyone will declare God's dominion, that's part of our vision for Mashiach, is a very beautiful one, is one that we have over here.
And by the way, that's one of the distinguishing features between Judaism on the one hand and Christianity
so that's
on
exactly,
the other.
Exactly. That's part of her research, and that's exactly right. We're talking about.
I've always taught students that any philosophy, whether it's secular or religious, that says things aren't going to be great till everybody thinks like I do, that is a recipe for disaster. Because first you start persuading people nicely, but then you get annoyed, and then it could lead to destruction.
So it's part of the complexity of our the 21st century
absolutely.
Landscape.
Absolutely. So I'm always so proud that we don't have that insistence.
That's 100%. And there's also, I think, a distinction between those who believe that it has to come now and those who say it's off in the future. Difference between millennials and non-millennials and the like. In other words, if you can defer it to a later moment in history, and in a way that's an easier pill to swallow for some faith communities. I'm not giving up on my fundamental belief. I just came to understand that I can't force it and impose it on others right now. We'll get there. We'll get there. So I'm okay with that. I can live with the world in which my Christian friend will tell me, don't worry, comes the end of days, you all come to see the truth, you all convert to Christianity, right? And I'll agree to disagree. I'm like, I can be your friend, that's not a problem, right? Okay, so like, we'll see, right? We'll get there and we'll see what happens, that I can deal with. It's the immediacy, it's the millennial, it's that there's a date that it needs to come and we need to force that to come and bring that about. That's where I think it becomes extremely dangerous, 100%. So the first thing I want to observe about this tefillah, which is just so beautiful, is that I think it can be divided into two basic components, and this is what I want to look at. In the first part, it's very interesting, right? First, let's make a general observation. Where do you see the psukim being cited the most? Where do you see biblical text here?
Throughout,
good.
Yeah.
First part, second part, beginning, latter parts. All right, Aliza says the second part, right? You see a series of extended quotations specifically in the later part of the tefillah. And in fact, in the later part of the tefillah, that's the overwhelming majority. You're citing either from biblical texts or you're citing from the tefillot, which themselves incorporate a pasuk. But that's really the thrust of the end of it. Notice that at the beginning, Avinu Sheba Shemayim, Tzur Yisrael, V'galo, Berechim Dan Yisrael, beautiful, gorgeous turns of phrase, but they're not directly quoted from Sukkim or from other texts. And in fact, some have suggested, in fact, I saw an article online by the Dr. Yoel Rappel that I mentioned, the one who is writing the book and wrote his dissertation on the Tefillah Shel Hamdinah. He made this observation as well, that there really seem to be two fundamentally different parts or sections to the Tefillah. The first is written in modern Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Isn't this striking? And it's about the state today. It's not about the diaspora. It's not about Yimot HaMashiach in the future. It's not about something that's deferred to some distant era. It's about today. It's about God blessing the Medina Hayom. And so we say Avinu Sheba Shemayim. And the language, again, is beautiful and is rooted in classical texts. but also has more of a modern feel to it.
Now that phrase, "Ufros aleh sukkos lemecha," that's directly from the Hashkidim.
Absolutely. So it's not 100%. We're going to come to that in a moment. And I think that's going to be significant too. So it's not absolute, but it's certainly, I think, ushlach orcha mancha the rasheha sareha viyatzeha. That is an identifiably more modern phrase. By the way, even Avinu Shabbat Shemayim comes up elsewhere. But we're gonna, even Avinu Shabbat Shemayim, which we'll see what the roots are, that's not usually how we refer to God in prayer. How do we usually refer to God in prayer?
Avinu Malkeinu.
Avinu Malkeinu is a classic one, and many others as well. But Avinu Shabbat Shemayim is not typically found. Why do they choose to use this? You wonder what's going on over here. But it seems that this was an intentional decision. So that essentially what you have over here is two clauses that represent the tension, the beautiful tension that animates the state of Israel today. You have the modern elements in modern language, of course drawn on traditional categories and on religious precedents. And yet it's a prayer for the here and now. The Medina that God has bestowed upon us today should be successful in the modern sense of the term, should be successful also in the religious sense of the term. But the new, updated, fresh opportunity that we have before us, God should bless that. And yet at the same time, there's a recognition that often the distance, this is just a step in a process. It's reshit zmicha geulatenu. It's the beginning of a process of redemption that is not something that only exists now, but is something that we aspire toward in the future, on the one hand, and yet at the same time, that vision for the future is drawn upon past categories for which we've been praying for thousands of years, which go back to literally the Torah itself. Parshat Nitzavim, Parshat Atshuva, is not about a bunch of Jews just performing repentance on their own. It's not about the Yomim Noraim. It's about Yimot HaMashiach. It's about Yomim Noraim as a model for what might once be, what can be in front of us, what this fledgling state can be in the future. And that was what we've been praying for thousands of years. This is Rav Herzog saying to the religious Zionists, right, I'm going to have your cake, and I'm going to eat it too. I'm going to have the best of both worlds. It's going to be a modern Medinat Yisrael. It's going to be successful from a political standpoint, from a military standpoint. Every single element of what it means to be a successful secular state that you envision, Ben Gurion, the government, and everyone else, we're going to have that. And we're also going to thereby, in a religious sense, be achieving the aspiration that we've been praying for thousands of years. So that's really the marriage. That's really the sort of the poetry that's taking place, the beautiful tension that brings together the different strands of this tefillah. Okay, in light of that introduction, let's take a look at the actual phrases. Let's work through some of these. So the first one, you said, Avinu Shabbat Shemayim. And you all remarked, what's going on? It's an unusual kind of phrase. Where does that come from? So, I give you some sources. Page 7. Bottom page 6, rather. The Hebrew really starts on page 7. So I'll give you two sources. Tell me what you think is the common thread that runs throughout through both sources. So Sota Mem Tav and Aleph. Sota 49a, the Gemara teaches us as follows. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair Omer, again on top of page 7 on the source sheet in the Hebrew. And Tana Rabban and the rabbis talk. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair Omer. Rabbi Pinchas son of Yair said, Mishachara Beit HaMikdash, from the time the temple was destroyed, Boshu Chaverim, Uvenei Chorin, the Chaverim, which is a sort of rabbinic class, and free men of noble lineage were ashamed. The Chafu Rosham, they covered their heads out of shame. The Nidalzulu An Shemasa, men of the Gavru Bali Zerah Bali Lashon, men of, from the time of the destruction of the temple, men of action have essentially dwindled out, and these strong men and these smooth talkers have taken over. They've become dominant. There's no one who's seeking out the wisdom of God, who's seeking out Yirat Shemayim, and therefore, Ami Lanu Li Sha'en, right? Upon whom should we, right? Should we rely, right? Alavinu Shiva Shemayim, right? You might be familiar with the song. Is it Shrucky? Yeah. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. No. I thought. What?
It was not.
Oh, okay. Well, we need a Shrucky researcher in the room. So anyhow, so this is right. This is those who are familiar with the tune is a very popular tune in Israel. It's a very good one. Maybe we should introduce it for next year for your for Yom
HaTzvaot.
How does it go? Just a little sample. Oh, yeah. It's appended to it, right? There you go. So
weddings a lot.
Yeah. So this is, it's very popular in Israel. It's even more popular than it is here. But yeah, it's a great wedding song. So the so it's interesting that let's leave this. So that's the first source. We'll talk about this in a second. So this is a description of the Churban and the tragedy. And so right in that context, in Almi Lanu Lishain, upon whom can we rely? Avinu Shabashamayim, upon our Father in heaven. Only our Father in heaven. Brachot la mebed amebed, the next one. 32. Bivam Rabbi Lazar, miyom shechara Beit HaMikdash, from the day the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, nifseka chomat barzel ben Yisrael la'avihem Shabashamayim. There was an iron wall that separated between the Jews and their Father in heaven. Whenever I think about this image, it's not exactly identical, but I always think of the Iron Curtain. That's just something about it. I mean, Lahavil, it's very different, obviously, but the Chomat Barzel, there's this impenetrable barrier between the Jews and their Father in Heaven. That same phrase, Ne'emar, Pasuk Nichezkel, V'atakach l'cha mechavat barzel, v'natatau takir barzel b'incha v'in ha'ir, God instructs Yechezkel to place an iron wall between himself and the city, which is a sign for the house of Israel that they've been, they're basically in Kirin. It's a nevuah of destruction. So these are two classic rabbinic usages that invoke the term Avinu Shebashamayim, our Father in Heaven. What do you make of that? What's the meaning of Avinu Shebashamayim, and what's the common denominator between these sources? Emily.
So I was thinking that it really suggests, I mean, that's a bit severe, the Iron Curtain from Source 9, but it does suggest a real distance between God and us. And it also, at least for me, and it suggests that what's going on now, what we're capable of doing, yes, we have to pray for the welfare of those who are physically protecting us and so on, but in the end, it's Kain Bashamayim, that it has to do with God is sort of, I mean, whenever I
think it's implicit, is a critique of those who would see our security as purely dependent upon our physical protectors.
Right. Every time I hear Avinu Shebashamayim, I sort of feel like raising my head towards the sky. Mm-hmm. So I think it emphasizes puts our accomplishments into a certain context of spirituality.
So it frames as we're about to talk about the importance of the state of Israel, but we can't begin to talk about that without recognizing that in the end,
higher power.
Ultimately. Go ahead.
I think it's a difference with us not, like Shachanti B'Toch HaMishkan is not resting among us. We don't have a Beit HaMikdash, Yerushalayim is not established, not been yet, in that place. So it's a difference that we feel like the distance. It's the
So in my mind, it evoked the pasuk Hashemayim Shamayim Lashem V'Ha'aretz Natan Livnei Adam.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So this idea of this sort of this dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shamayim is God's kingdom, but the kingdom on earth belongs to man.
Mm-hmm.
And just to have that. There's a clear distinction,
mm-hmm.
and a certain, almost like an aloofness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, distance. And I think that's a commentary between the suggestions that you've offered, 100%. So I think that there's a little bit of this. I think there's this sense of that of sobriety when we enter this tefillah. Again, they want us to celebrate and to daven and at the same time it's the recognition that it's incomplete, that there is that ambivalence. And that, I think, is, and using, ironically, a term from the Churban, which seems so ill-fitting to, I mean, that's really striking. That's very unusual, right? But it's Avinu Shabbat Shemayim is the recognition that this is a work in progress. And that's really the tension, this tefillah, that God is manifest, and yet he's not fully manifest until the Beit HaMikdash is here. So it's, again, they're trying to straddle two worlds. There's the secular Zionist world, and they embrace part of that vision, and yet there's the recognition that this needs to be a vehicle for spiritual success, for the building of the Beit HaMikdash, ultimately, and for everything that that represents in terms of the larger constellation of religious Jewish values.
Wouldn't you think that this would have kind of calmed the Haredim down a little bit in terms of accepting, at that time, I'm saying, the Tzva, the day, if they had known?
Maybe. This is a really interesting suggestion. I think as soon as they put in Rishit Smicha Gulatina, they were dead in the water. Like, it was over. Like, there was no Haredi who was ever going to, like, it's like that time was cast. And it's not being adopted in the Haredi circles. So I don't know, but it could be that there were concerns, again, going back to the different elements in the religious council and these, I don't know what the conversation, the backstory was, these conversations with these chief rabbis in different cities. It's possible that there was, they felt that it was important to recognize, you know, as you know, even if not for the Haredi Haredim, but for the more conservative elements of the Zionist world, it's possible that that was what motivated it. It's possible. If you think that's striking, and look at the next phrase. Sorry, we're going back and forth so much. If you go to Avinu Shabbat Shemayim, so now we appreciate where that comes from. Tzur Yisrael v'goalo. Okay. Tzur Yisrael v'goalo, the rock of Israel and its redeemer. So where does that come from? What does it represent? So Tzur Yisrael, the rock of Israel in Tanakh, also has a relatively severe context to it, set of meanings. It very often, when we talk about God as the tsur, what does that conjure? God is the rock. So on the one hand, he protects us, but at the same time, if there's sort of a sense that is often associated with even tragedy, with the presence of God during difficult times. Or for God's justice. That description of justice very often. Tzur Yisrael goes along with that. If you look at Source 10, I gave you just one example, Pasuk from Parshat Hazinu. Hatzur Tamim Pa'alo. This is in context of God's judgment, which can be severe at times. Kichol Derachav Hatzur Tamim Pa'alo. Kichol Derachav Mishpat. The rock. His deeds are perfect. All of his ways are just. Kalam Anavi Inavel. Sadik V'Yasharu. Faithful God. Never false. True and upright is he. Not only describing acts of kindness for the Jewish people, Hazinu, right, has a very harsh element. And if you continue with the song, you'll see the word sur appears in the tefillah shira in Hazinu on a number of occasions. So Tzur Yisrael also kind of picks up on the sense that God is Avinu Shabbat Shemayim, even at moments of distance, God is still present, but even in moments when his presence is not immediately felt or manifest. So it kind of picks up on that theme. At the same time, what is Tzur Yisrael? It's an ironic, it's a twofold term, I think. It's a double entendre almost. Right? Where else do we use Tzur Yisrael?
With Hanukkah.
Most Tzur Yeshuati, so that's clearly in context of salvation. Very
also,
nice.
Right before the Amidah, Tzur Yisrael.
Okay, Tzur Yisrael. That's the right. That's presumably the immediate reference, right? Tzur Yisrael, Kuma Biezra Yisrael, Rock of Israel. So here, it's like in Tehillim, you have this the imagery of the rock, right? So even when our enemies are trying to get us, right, still God is the rock. He's the barrier, right? He's the protective agency that ensures the redemption, the physical salvation, ultimately the redemption of Israel. And so that's clearly what we're doing here is Tzur Yisrael has this dual meaning. It goes back to Avinu Shabbat Shemayim, acknowledges the sense of distance at times, and yet transitions already, literally within the course of few words. We're five words into tefillah. Look at the brilliance of this. Avinu Shabbat Shemayim. Tzur Yisrael v'galo, we've transitioned already from an acknowledgement of the imperfection of our scenario to recognition at the same time that this has an element of redemption. Tzur Yisrael v'galo. Right? So, right, where does the Tzur Yisrael v'galo, where do those go together? Well, first of all, That's Gaal Yisrael. That's the bracha. That's the context of prayer for salvation. What's more is that in the ancient Israeli Sidurim, they actually had that phraseology together in that tefillah. Where we say Tzur Yisrael, in ancient Israel, around the time of the Gemara, when the Talmud Yerushalmi, when the Israeli Talmud was written, we actually have a record that they used to say not just Tzur Yisrael, as we say, but Tzur Yisrael v'Goala. So if you take a look, in the Bavli, it's just, they have Tzur Yisrael, and they have a Gaal Yisrael, and that's it. And I gave that to you in source 11 from Gemara Masechet. But if you take a look at source 12 on page 8, you'll see an example, and there's a parallel to this in Yerushalmi, that that we actually, they used to say, Melech Tzur Yisrael v'Gaalo. Right? That they actually would say, they would bless God, who is the king, the rock of Israel, and its redeemer. This is also ingenious. Because what are they drawing from? Which text of the Siddur?
Ancient.
And from where?
Israel.
Ah. In Bavel, they imply, okay, Tzur Yisrael. That's very nice. And hopefully that will lead to redemption. If you want to get Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo, the rock of Israel and its redeemer, we're reclaiming an Israeli tradition from thousands of years ago. Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo. We're going back to the fuller-fledged redemption. It's a greater element, and Israel was always more closely associated with the redemption. Sure, there was a Purim story. Sure, there are diaspora miracles that are extremely important. But if you want the fuller sense of Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo, the real Gaal Yisrael, for that, you got to come to Israel. Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo.
A regular Gaal. Yeah, right. How did it come to be that the Babylonian Talmud became the more central one?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm already late on time. So let's... already late on time.
But it does
so,
raise the question.
I just realized with that. We're running an hour. All right. I just realized we're an hour. So, good. So let's make a time to talk. Well, for another class. Okay. Very quickly, just to move this along. See, the time's late. So, Tzur Yisrael v'Goalo, Barichet Medina Yisrael Reishit Tzmichat Geulatenu. So, a couple of things. First of all, Medina Yisrael was a phrase that the Zionists used, but that the rabbis did not traditionally use. However, if you take a look, Rav Kook, well before the founding of the state, which I know must have been well before the founding of the state, because he died in 1935. You take a look, well before there was an actual state of Israel, in source 13, in Orot HaKodesh, Rav Kook uses the term of Medina, talking about, and he actually calls this in the third line there, Medina Zohi Medina Tinu Medina Yisrael. This state of Israel is our. This is our Medina Yisrael. Rav Kook presciently used the term Medina Yisrael long before the founding of the state, and they probably were partly drawing on this. This is a well-known passage. Yisod Kisei Hashem Ba'olam, the foundation of God's throne in the world. Okay, now I have to give a drop of time at least to Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, and then a few more points, and then we will send everyone on the way for the rest of your holiday. Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. This has a very long history. You saw that it was not clear there. If anyone is interested in researching this term further, this is a whole shiur in its own right, and in my machzor that I've been pulling out for Yom HaTzma'ut and Yom Yerushalayim, there's an article by Rabbi J.J. Schachter on the topic of just Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. What does it mean? Where does it come from? Etc. The religious Zionists, going back to the 19th century already, started using terms drawn from rabbinic literature to refer to the idea of a partial redemption. So they say things, for example, that are drawn on earlier sources. They talk about how the idea of the partial redemption. I gave you a copy, didn't come out so well, but it's good enough, I think, from Rabbi Schachter's article. I'm not going to have time to read it now, but I want to recommend it to you on pages 9 and 10. That's a segment from his article, and he summarizes. So he says, for example, that Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer and Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, who were proto-Zionists who were living in the 19th century, they used terminology like me'at me'at. There was a little bit of redemption with a return to Israel. Kima kima, just a little bit at a time. And these kinds of phraseologies. Rav Kook never used the full-fledged phraseology of Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, but he did use in his writings almost every plausible plausible variation thereof. Almost every other way of saying that, he used that language. He used Atchalta de Geula, which we did use last night in the Nusach for the Tefillah. He even quotes Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who is the father-in-law of Rav Amital, the Rosh Shiva, Korosh Shiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who was from the much more Haredi camp but had a sympathy for the religious Zionist movement, actually called it Atchalta de Geula, he quotes over here, which is really striking. And then he comes to Rav Herzog on the next page, on page 10 of your source sheets, and he says that Rav Herzog is hedging and is building on exactly this tradition. I gave you on the bottom there, source 16, the source for Kima Kima, very beautiful Gemara, an incident, or Yerushalmi in Brachot, an incident regarding Rabbi Chiya the Great and Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, who were walking in the Arbel Valley at dawn. They saw the burst of the first light. Rabbi Chiya the Great said to Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, "My Rabbi, such is the redemption of Israel. A bit, as long as it continues, it increases. Kima Kima, kol ma shehi holechet, hi rava veholechet." So it's like you're going out. This is it. This is how Rav Herzog, Rav Uziel, Agnon saw Reshit Tzmichat Goaltenu, Kima Kima. They were drawing on a very rich history here. It's like when you go out, you see that first burst of dawn, and you know that so long as this day is continuing, you're going to have, right, or at least until its apex, you're going to have the light continuing to go. Is there any moment? Is it a burst of light like all of a sudden it was dark and now it's bright outside? No, it's a process. Kima kima, a little bit at a time. Rishit zmichat ulatenu. It's the beginning of the flowering of the redemption. If you take a look at the tefillah, there are many other references to the Messianic era, which are very, very beautiful. If you take a look, for example, Ufros Aleha Sukkat Shlomecha, that's said at night also in context of redemption. Also a very beautiful image. We ask God, that's also, right? We have a couple of beautiful images. That's another one of them. There are a number of allusions to redemption that are woven throughout. And of course, I mentioned earlier the ends, which moves toward sort of the beautiful nature of the redemption. And I think if you tie everything together that we've seen, there's always more to say, but I think this is really the essence, the heart and soul of the Tefillah Shlomo HaMdina, is that it in of itself tells the story and aspires toward a certain story, a certain narrative of what the state of Israel is and can become. If you think about it for a moment and go over what we've seen, Avinu Shavah Shemayim, we start off with a recognition that's taken from Churban. That's God as distant. Tzur Yisrael itself has a complex history. So we recognize from the outset that it's imperfect, that there's still an element of destruction. The Beit HaMikdash has not been rebuilt, and it's wartime. Right? There's an existential war for the survival of a new country. Not all is perfect. Not all is 100% well. And there's a recognition that God remains distant, and that religiously, the state is not where it needs to be. It's Tzur Yisrael. Yes, it's Galo. Yes, it's redemption. But it's Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu. It's the beginning. It is. It isn't. It's the process has begun, but it's only just getting underway. And yet there's the recognition, especially, I think that's the fulcrum. Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu is not just a controversial phrase. It's a beautiful phrase that captures the transition of this field, everything revolves around it. Until then, it was a little bit more complex, and yet all of a sudden, the geula, we start to see it's the beginning of a process. It's not there yet, but it's a process that we are hopeful and optimistic will ultimately continue. And that leads to Ufros Aleha Sukkat Shlomecha. And then we're ready for that transition. It's if we get this right, if we're able to make this kima kima, just a little bit at a time, to make this into the seeds of the redemption, then ultimately through that process, what will emerge from there? What will come out? The messianic visions, right? Then it's going to be not just the Jews of this country, it's going to be all Jews from throughout the world. It's going to be Kibbutz Galiot. It's not going to just be a secular state, but it's going to involve Umal Hashem Elokecha. It's going to involve a circumcision of the heart, which will lead to the time of the redemption. And it's not just going to be the Jewish people in Israel and throughout the world, but it's going to be ultimately all of humanity, right? And we evoke the Rosh Hashanah symbolism. We think about the Yomim Noraim, and last night we had many Yomim Noraim motifs. I think this is the reason for that as well. And ultimately, that is the aspiration. So Avinu Shoshanim is not just a carefully crafted and deeply meaningful prayer, but it's one that moves. It's one that actually undergoes its own story of development as we say the prayer. And hopefully this will make it an even more meaningful tefillah for each of us in our own religious lives, but hopefully also this should indeed be the story of our people, the story of Yom HaAtzma'ut, that although things are far from complete, that sense of Churban should give way to the beginnings of a process of redemption, which should indeed flower to be the full-fledged redemption that we anticipate and pray for. Chag Sameach, Mo'adim L'Simchat to everyone. Yashar Koach.